Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, we have oh so much to talk about tonight, including all those Republican presidential candidates coming to Iowa this week, months ahead of next year's GOP caucuses, and those Republican state House lawmakers trying to impose their will on the Democratic Party's presidential nominating process here in Iowa. Yes, that's happening. But we start with the biggest story of the week by far. The state Supreme Court hearing oral arguments last Tuesday about whether the court should continue to prevent the state from enforcing the so-called fetal heartbeat abortion ban. This is an important and complex story, and we're going to break it down step by step into an understandable form. Start it out, Laura.
So this is a law that the Republican-controlled legislature passed in 2018. The proponents call it a heartbeat bill. The opponents call it a six-week ban because it would ban almost all abortions after about the six-week mark, which is estimated to be about 98% of abortions. Of course, many people don't even realize they're pregnant that early in a pregnancy. So soon after the law was signed by Governor Kim Reynolds, a lawsuit was filed by Planned Parenthood and the Emma Goldman Clinic in Iowa City. The law was enjoined. It never went into effect. A Polk County District Court struck it down in early January 2019, and then the governor chose not to appeal. So the law never went into effect. But last summer, after the Iowa Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned their abortion rights precedents, the governor went to court to say she would like to have the injunction lifted on this 2018 law on the grounds that the legal reasoning behind striking it down no longer is operative. So it's a very complicated case procedurally, and we may not get a decision from the Iowa Supreme Court on whether a ban on abortion that early in pregnancy is or is not unconstitutional, because they may decide this case on purely procedural grounds.
So during the oral arguments last week, lawyers representing the state said the fetal heartbeat law should be allowed to take effect since the courts have ruled, as you indicate, that neither the state constitution nor the U.S. Constitution guarantees the right to an abortion. Now, lawyers for Planned Parenthood urged the court to dismiss the governor's appeal and that the injunction against the fetal heartbeat law should remain in place. Take it from there.
There are a number of separate legal arguments. First of all, the lawyers representing the state, and it's a private law firm called the Alliance Defending Freedom, they're involved in a lot of the abortion fights around the country. They acknowledged that this appeal was filed very late. Iowa rules of civil procedure normally say you have 12 months to appeal a final judgment from a court. This, of course, is far outside that 12-month period, but they say courts have an inherent authority to revisit an injunction when there has been an underlying change in the law. And they say this change in the law occurred when the Iowa Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned their abortion rights precedents. Furthermore, they say that under the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, that the rational basis standard, which is the lowest bar for the government to clear, that should be the standard for reviewing abortion restrictions, and that this law satisfies that standard. Now, Planned Parenthood is making a number of separate arguments. First, they're saying that the law is void because it was unconstitutional when it was passed, and therefore it can't be revived now. They're also saying that procedurally, this issue isn't even properly before the court because nothing in Iowa's rules of civil procedure allow an appeal to be filed this late, and the courts don't have an inherent authority to go back and fix it now. They're also saying that under the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling last summer, the Iowa Supreme Court did not establish rational basis as a standard for reviewing abortion restrictions. Rather, they said that a balancing test called an undue burden standard will be in effect for now, and that later courts will decide what's the proper standard. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that undue burden standard, but the Iowa Supreme Court has not. So the Planned Parenthood's attorneys are saying that this is right now, this law clearly poses an undue burden on women seeking an abortion. In fact, even the Alliance Defending Freedom's attorney acknowledged that this law could not survive undue burden analysis, but he said that the court should look at rational basis. So there are just a lot of different legal issues. And as I said, they may end up deciding this on a procedural grounds and leaving open the question of whether the Iowa Supreme Court might uphold some future abortion ban that looks very much like this 2018 law.
Well, I said it was complex, and it is. Let me try to summarize the core question in the case. If the permanent injunction of the law relied on court precedent that has since been overturned, should the injunction be overturned as well?
And that is one of the key questions. But again, there are many ways they could do this. If the Iowa Supreme Court holds that, yes, it is possible, courts do have this inherent authority to revisit a permanent injunction, that doesn't mean that they would necessarily lift the injunction right away. They may remand the case to lower court, Polk County District Court, and then let arguments proceed about whether the injunction should be lifted. Of course, the Alliance Defending Freedom and the state are asking the court to lift the injunction right away and allow this abortion ban to be enforced while the litigation proceeds. And in fact, they're also asking the Iowa Supreme Court to just end the case right here with a decision in their favor, but that may or may not happen. If it goes back to lower court, it could be that the injunction remains in place and then abortion would remain legal while the battle continues in court.
The court, as you indicated, is expected to make a decision perhaps by the end of June. Now, until then, we should emphasize, as we have many times on this broadcast, that abortion remains legal in Iowa up to the 20th week of pregnancy.
That's right. It is legal in Iowa. Iowa does not have any restrictions on abortion method other than that there you have to have an ultrasound and there is a 24-hour waiting period in effect.
So here's one of those weird sidelines that may or may not be important. It turns out the governor was in the Supreme Court's secure office area before those oral arguments. She is the lead plaintiff in the case. So she bypassed the public entrance to the judicial branch building and entered the secure areas. This is highly unusual.
It is extremely unusual. And I will say I was down at the Iowa Supreme Court building last Tuesday. The oral arguments were scheduled to start at 9. I got there around 8:45 and I was in a media room. I wasn't in the main chamber. I was in a separate room they set up for journalists. And I heard somebody say that the governor was upstairs in the courtroom, which was surprising. And I can't find anyone who remembers a time when a governor of Iowa attended oral arguments in the Iowa Supreme Court. That alone is unusual. But I asked if anybody saw her come in the building. None of the other reporters who got there earlier than I did, nobody had seen her come in. So we found out the next day what happened. Her security detail with the Iowa State Patrol used their badges to access a non-public entrance, an elevator that's primarily used by the Supreme Court justices and staff. And they went straight up to the floor where the private offices are. I mean, you know, you said it may or may not be important. If you talk to attorneys, this was wild. I mean, many, many people in the legal community were talking about this and it at least creating the appearance of impropriety and questioning whether this is an act of intimidation or even a violation of the separation of powers, I heard some people say last Wednesday. I mean, it's just unheard of that a litigant would be back there in those private offices. That just doesn't happen. And the governor's office, they didn't answer my questions about this incident. They did give a statement to Iowa Capital Dispatch saying that this was in response to a legitimate security threat. But that's not clear to me. I mean, the judicial branch building is very well guarded. I mean, you have to go through a metal detector. You have to put all bags and cases through an X-ray scanner to go in there. And when the governor has gone into the building at other times for other events, she hasn't used that private entrance. So I don't really know what was going on, but within the legal community, that was a big deal. And I also wanted to just mention quickly that in addition to that case, the big abortion case, there was another case argued last Tuesday involving the Iowa State Patrol as a defendant. So in fact, the Iowa State Patrol had representatives in those private offices, and that agency was a defendant. So that in itself was improper, even leaving aside with the governor's presence.
And when I said it may or may not be important, we don't know what the situation was. It may have been wholly innocent or it may have been something else. We do not know. It does create an appearance of impropriety. There's no question about that.
Well, it was important enough for the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Susan Christensen, to ask her counsel to send a letter the next day to all counsel involved in both those cases, the abortion case and the case involving the Iowa State Patrol, because I believe that the letter was sent to the attorneys because in the rules of judicial conduct, there's something called ex parte communication, where judges aren't supposed to have contact with parties to a case that's in front of their courtroom without the lawyers being present. And so that's basically what happened. So, I mean, it was certainly, it was unusual enough for the Chief Justice to have that letter sent and have it posted on a database that all lawyers can access.
And of course, while abortion made big news in Iowa last week, it also spilled over to the rest of the country, almost inevitably, the U.S. Supreme Court on Friday temporarily restored full access to a key abortion drug. Well, it takes more time to fully consider issues raised in a court challenge. This was highly confusing last week, involving multiple court decisions, and the Supreme Court's going to decide something perhaps by this Wednesday. Let's break this down as simply as we can.
And this has been coming down the pike for a few months. So after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Roe v. Wade precedent last summer, a group of doctors formed an organization and they filed a lawsuit in Amarillo, Texas. Why Amarillo, Texas? Because there is only one federal district court judge down there, a Trump appointee who is known to be very strongly anti-abortion. And they knew that if they filed in this particular federal district court, that it would be guaranteed to land in his courtroom. And they were asking that the FDA approval of mifepristone, which is a drug used in most medication abortions, also used in miscarriage care. The FDA approved it in the year 2000. And so they're asking the judge to revoke this. So this is something people have been talking about for months as a problem that could come up. And in fact, on April 7th, that's exactly what happened, the long anticipated outcome that this judge in Texas, federal judge, issued basically a nationwide ruling that says the FDA needs to revoke or suspend its approval of mifepristone. And he did put a stay on his own ruling to give the government time to appeal. But this is something that would affect not just red states where abortion is banned, but if the U.S. Supreme Court upholds this decision, then it could threaten access in every state, even California, Maryland, New York states, where the state constitution basically protects the right to an abortion. So this is very unusual. And Big Pharma is now weighing in because they don't want courts to get involved with revoking FDA approval of drugs many years after the fact. And it's a very complicated case, further complicated by the fact that a different federal judge in the state of Washington issued a competing ruling that said the FDA had to maintain the availability of this medication, mifepristone. So the U.S. Supreme Court, which said in the Dobbs decision that they were returning the abortion issue to the states, has a big mess on their hands right now.
Laura, that's our job, to simplify complicated issues, and we try to do that every Monday night right here on Capitol Week. One more quick note on this. Abortion providers in Iowa say they do have another option available no matter what happens with mifepristone.
That's right. So the current regimen for medication abortions, and by the way, those are estimated to be about half of abortions nationally, and about 80% of abortions in Iowa are conducted through medication rather than surgical methods. So it's really quite a large number. And the usual regimen is this drug mifepristone, followed by a second dose of misoprostol. But it's possible, and in some parts of the world, this is done just using misoprostol alone, and Planned Parenthood of North Central States confirmed in a press conference last week that they are making preparations to do this if the availability of mifepristone becomes threatened. Planned Parenthood has always been very clear that they follow the laws of any state where they operate, so they are not going to try to continue to distribute mifepristone if there is a federal ruling that says that that shouldn't happen.
And Laura, quickly before we take our first cutaway, the state Supreme Court also made a decision last week saying the governor has to comply with the public records law. And full disclosure, you were involved in this case.
Yes, this is a case. I'm one of the plaintiffs. The ACLU of Iowa was representing me in my role, not with KHOI, but in my role at Bleeding Heartland. Clark Kaufman of Iowa Capital Dispatch and Randy Evans, the executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, we sued in December of 2021 over the fact that the governor's office was not fulfilling public records requests. We had 8 requests that were outstanding. The oldest was filed by me in April of 2020, so that took more than 18 months. And soon after we filed the lawsuit, the governor's office provided many of the records, not all of them, but many of them, and then sought to have the case dismissed as moot, saying that they had supplied all the records. So the Polk County District Court last year in May rejected the governor's motion to dismiss, and that's what the Iowa Supreme Court was deciding and ruled on last Friday, unanimously ruled against the state's motion to dismiss our lawsuit and said it can go back to lower court to proceed. So just to be really clear, the Iowa Supreme Court did not decide the merits of our claims about whether the governor and the governor's staff violated the open records law. They just ruled that this kind of case that alleges that the governor's office violated the law by not providing records in a timely manner, that kind of lawsuit can proceed.
All right, let's take a quick break here. It is 15 after the hour, and you are in tune with an extended edition of KHOI Radio's Capital Week. Extended, yes, because we want to bring in my old buddy Tom Beal, who has some key words about how you can help support this radio station. Thomas, the airwaves are yours.
Thank you very much for inviting me. We don't like to use the O word in my community, so we'll just say longtime friends. And I appreciate being part of the talkathon, today's extraordinary program, exploring all of the issues that confront the legislature and the various courts. Your program, frankly, is one of the real jewels of our program schedule. I'm not just flattering you. I'm telling you that you, too, do an extraordinary job of helping people understand what's going on in this very complicated world. And so we're delighted to be able to broadcast your program and put it on our website as well. And we can do this because we're a community radio station. We're not relying on advertising to pay the bills. Instead, we rely on our listeners to pay the bills. And so a couple times a year, we come to you and we say, please make a contribution, or you can become a member of KHOI, become part of our family, in fact. We have a basic membership of $60 a year, but many of our listeners contribute much more than that to help pay all the bills. Now, the way to do that is to go on the website, khoifm.org/membership. If you do that, you'll be taken right to the site, and it'll walk you through the procedure. We're going to be sending a letter out to some of our supporters, and you may want to respond by mail. And if so, that will be great as well. Or if you're in the area, you could come to the station. Is it 611 Kellogg? Now, Michael, I keep forgetting our new address.
It's 622 Douglas.
Oh, well, now there you are. 622 Douglas. You can drop by. It's a magnificent old Victorian building that you'd enjoy. But still, go on our website. That's the easiest way to do it, khoifm.org/membership. Now, this is such a busy week, and there's so much news to discuss that I'm going to turn the program back over to our two experts and let you continue talking about politics in Iowa.
Tom, thank you very much. You are a good man, and it's been my pleasure to know you all these years. You're not an old man. You're a longtime friend. All right. Tom will come back in a bit. All right. We are starting a new feature here, at least a new title for something we've been talking about a long time. We're going to call this, Laura, Capital Week's Caucus Almanac. We've been talking about the caucuses for a long time. This is our slogan, our headline. And do we have a lot to talk about tonight? And including one of those, you can't make this up stories. State House lawmakers last week advanced a bill that would require Iowans to be physically present to take part in the state's caucuses and to register more than 2 months ahead of time to do so. Now, this is being passed by the Republican lawmakers in the House. This would completely screw up Democrats' plans to allow mail-in participation next year for their caucuses. Wow, that's all I can say.
There are a lot of angles to this, and I want to go back to something we talked about 3 weeks ago after that second funnel deadline. And I mentioned that I don't pay as much attention to the legislature's funnel deadlines as I used to, and this is exactly the reason why. In theory, any bills not related to taxation or spending that weren't passed by a chamber and a committee in the other chamber by the end of March should be dead for this year. And yet the Ways and Means Committee chair in the House, Bobby Kaufman, introduced this bill last week. They put it on a fast track, went through subcommittee, and the next day went through the Ways and Means Committee in the House, both on party line votes. And it looks like Republicans are very committed to passing this. This is unusual, to say the least. And there are two angles of it, as you mentioned. First, it would say Iowans must be physically present to take part in a political party's caucus. And then also, whereas for at least 15 years, Iowa has allowed people to change their party registration on the night of the Iowa caucuses so that somebody can, a no party voter can participate on either the Republican or the Democratic side, or somebody can switch. This says that you would have to be a registered member of that party at least 70 days before the caucus. And, you know, a lot of things happen in the last 70 days before a caucus that can change people's minds. And this would be really big. And one of the reasons that now, although Bobby Kaufman, the bill sponsor, has said this, the main purpose of the bill is to make sure New Hampshire doesn't jump the line and go ahead of Iowa. Many people were commenting last week that he is a paid advisor to Donald Trump's campaign, and it is perceived that limiting the ability of no party voters to participate in the caucus is something that could work in Donald Trump's favor, because his approval rating is so much higher among registered Republicans than it is among Iowans who are not registered with the GOP.
So New Hampshire state law requires it to hold the first presidential primary in the nation. Republicans are saying that if Iowa Democrats' caucus process too closely resembles a primary, New Hampshire is going to move up the date of its election. And indeed, New Hampshire Secretary of State said virtually the same thing last week. So it's a real mess right now.
It is. And the Iowa Democratic Party's chair, Rita Hart, said that this whole discussion is premature. First of all, she said that she was disappointed that the Republicans and the legislature hadn't talked to her about this bill before it was published. But she said Iowa Democrats have not finalized their plan. They do plan to have some kind of mail-in or remote participation. They're not calling it a ballot. They dispute that it would be a primary. They are going to maintain a caucus. But according to Bobby Kaufman and the other Republicans who are on the Ways and Means Committee, they say if you can participate without being in the room with your neighbors at a certain time on a certain evening, that it defeats the whole purpose of what a caucus is supposed to be, a party meeting to deal with party business. So there are a lot of things to be worked out. The Iowa Democratic Party for now says that they are still pursuing their plan to make caucuses more accessible by allowing people who can't be physically present to participate. That's something that's very important to the Democratic National Committee.
Meanwhile, Republicans are going to hold their caucus. Boy, I've got something in my throat. I think Tom Beal put something in there. Tom, take that away. All right. The Republicans are taking part. They're in the caucus. They're in the routine. Candidates are coming. Tim Scott came to Iowa again last week. Nikki Haley came to Iowa again last week. A whole slew of Republicans are coming to Iowa this coming week. So the Republicans are moving on. Democrats are floundering. It's wild.
Well, and this has been something we've talked about for the last several months, that Republicans are having a fairly normal caucus campaign. Nobody in the Republican National Committee wants to remove Iowa's role in the first in the nation. But what Bobby Kaufman said when he was presenting this bill in the subcommittee last week is that if there are problems with the Democratic caucus, eventually that could threaten the Republican caucus's position as well. And so that was, in his words, that was the impetus for this bill. One thing that I forgot to mention that I think is important, assuming the Republican legislators do end up passing this along party lines, the University of Iowa professor Derek Mueller, who is an election law expert, spoke to the media last week. He spoke to several reporters and said, there's a long line of U.S. Supreme Court rulings that say that states can only regulate internal party procedures with the consent of political parties, and that he thinks this raises some pretty serious constitutional problems if Republicans in the legislature pass a bill that affects how Democrats want to conduct their caucuses. He thinks that that might not hold up in court. Now, the Iowa Democratic Party, they did not say that they would definitely file a lawsuit to try to block this law, but that's a whole other wrinkle of this. But yes, as you say, Republicans are moving ahead with a relatively normal type of caucus campaign, with candidates coming and doing local events and trying to mingle with local activists and helping to raise money for Republican candidates in Iowa, just like usual.
With all of these candidates coming in, a Real Clear Politics average of polling last week showed that former President Trump is leading with 41%, followed by Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, with 20%, South Carolina governor, former governor Nikki Haley, 18%. Nobody else has very much to talk about. So at this point, with all the candidates still coming in, and with all of Donald Trump's problems, political problems, legal problems, he's still leading.
Oh, definitely. And when you say his problems, I mean, I'm not convinced that those are problems within the context of a Republican primary. His campaign raised a lot of money. since the indictment in New York. He is rising, the trend lines at least are favorable for him compared to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And it's looking very difficult to see what is the lane for some of these other Republican candidates. They need to find some way to differentiate themselves from Trump, but without alienating the majority of Republican voters, and including the most active ones, who still very much like the former president.
At this point, there really doesn't appear to be a venue, an avenue, that anyone can reasonably see for anybody other than Trump and perhaps DeSantis.
Well, it is interesting. I went to an event. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson was in Iowa last week, and I went to the event that he held in Des Moines at a VFW post. And it was kind of a classic Iowa caucus event in that the media outnumbered the participants there. But there were TV cameras, so he got, I'm sure he got his message in front of thousands of Iowans that way. And he had pretty strong words about Trump, about the party needing to move on from Donald Trump, and that if Donald Trump ends up being the nominee, Republicans are going to lose. And I thought that was interesting because he is really the only person carving out a lane saying that these indictments are in some ways disqualifying for Donald Trump. Everybody else is trying to say, well, yes, I think I have a good vision for the country, but also the indictments are a terrible thing and politically motivated. And I'm not sure, you know, Asa Hutchinson, I wouldn't put money on him doing well in the Iowa caucus, but he's putting himself in a position where if things do fall apart with Donald Trump, he is maybe in more of a position to capitalize than the others.
So the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition is going to hold its annual spring fundraiser at the Horizon Event Center in Clive this weekend. Former President Trump is going to be there on video. Vice President Mike Pence is going to be there. And Tim Scott's going to be there. Asa Hutchinson, Vivek Ramaswamy, Perry Johnson, some you've heard of, some you haven't. All the Republicans are going to be there except Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, so this is a big event that has always happened. They always get a lot of prominent people for the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition. This is one of the two most influential groups, the Family Leader, led by Bob Vanderplaats, being the other one. But the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, that gets a lot of very influential, very active party people there. And so I'm not sure how wise it is for, I think that Ron DeSantis, it may be a strategy for him to be above the fray, but I'm not sure how tenable that is for him to stay away from some of these big cattle call events.
And one other person who's not going to be there is former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, because he's decided he's not going to run.
That's right. He faced reality. He said that he and his wife, after much reflection and prayer, decided that they were not going to run for president. I think that I never saw any poll, either nationally or in any state, that suggested there was any interest in the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
All right, let's actually get on to the state legislature now. The state Senate first. And the Senate actually didn't do much in the last 3 weeks, which was stunning for us to say because we've been doing this fast-paced thing with the Senate and House. They had 3 weeks of no debates in the Senate, and then today, Monday, they got to work again.
Yes, this was very odd. I mean, the Senate, after March 22nd, did not have floor debate for about 3 weeks. There was a small amount of committee activity, but really not that much. And today, the Senate moved a lot of nominations of Governor Kim Reynolds' nominees to head state agencies or serve on influential boards, and then also started working on a lot of bills, including some controversial ones that are going to come up probably later this evening.
And one more note before we bring back Mr. Beal, the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee advanced the governor's health care bill.
Yes, this is the bill that includes a lot of things that the governor wants. She wants more money to be appropriated for this, more options for maternal support, that is supporting the pregnancy centers that don't refer people for abortions and discourage pregnant people from having abortions. She also wants to create grants to have health care in rural areas. There would be a fellowship that would try to encourage more OBGYNs to work in Iowa. So this bill advanced out of the Senate Appropriations Committee pretty much in the form that the governor wanted. There are a few differences between this bill and the House bill, but I anticipate that it shouldn't be too difficult for them to work those out.
And up next, the State House. But first, it's half past the hour, whatever hour you're listening to us in whatever time zone. And this is KHY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart. We are your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are going long tonight until later, so we can bring you messages on the need to support this community radio station. And here's my good friend, my longtime friend, Mr. Thomas Beal, who has some key words about how you can help support this radio station. I should point out that, Mr. Beal, you are one of the founders of this radio station, and you are to be given great credit for putting this thing on the air.
I am? Oh, thank you. Well, I wanted to say thank you for your kind words, and I appreciate the fact that you didn't choke up when you spoke them. But I want to ask our listeners, do you not find this program extraordinary in so many ways? Where else can you find out what is really going on at the state legislature and in some cases nationally? The analysis is superb. Really, it really is. I think that you spend half an hour or an hour with this program and you come away understanding better what's going on. You may not like it, or maybe you do, but at least you know what's going on, and I don't know where else you can find this information out. So that brings us to the message of the evening for KHOI, and that is we rely on our listeners to support the station, and that means we come to you and ask you to make a contribution of any amount, but we have a basic membership of $60 a year. Although many of our listeners give more because they value this station and they value programs like this one. They value it to the point where they will make a contribution. Sometimes every month they'll have an automatic deduction from their checking account. And that helps the station budget because then we know every month we have a certain amount of money coming in. So how do you make a contribution or become a member of KHOI? The easiest way to do it is to go on the webpage, khoifm.org/membership. And if you go to that site, it will walk you through the steps. And it's really quite easy and virtually painless to make a contribution or become a member of KHOI. And that means that your contribution will support programs like the one you're hearing, this incredibly just excellent program. I just think it's one of our best. And I'm so delighted that we have two experts willing to spend time. And incidentally, we're not paying them any money. They do this out of the, I think, love for their country, really, in a way, because what they tell you makes you a better voter and a more informed citizen. So once again, khoifm.org/membership. That's how you can make a contribution and keep this program and the station on the air. And now back to our two experts.
You know what? Laura and I are so proud to be doing this broadcast on this radio station. We were put together as a lark about 2.5 years ago, right after the November 2020 election. Laura, you'll remember that one. The day after the election, Ursula Rudenberg asked us to go on the air together. We had never heard of each other, never met each other. And somehow it worked, and this show is the result of that. And this is our 116th broadcast tonight, and I can't tell you how proud I am to work with you, Laura, for this radio station and together to help this station reach whatever potential it has, and it has a lot, and you are a great part of that.
Thank you. I need to just slightly correct the record. I am paid a small part-time salary for my work for KHOI, but I so appreciate the platform here. I love working with Dennis. I hope that the listeners out there will become members of KHOI because there is so much talk and music programming on this station that you can't find anywhere else. And it is just a great diversity of programming. And I enjoy the opportunity to discuss a lot of Iowa political stories that I don't always have time to write about on my own website. So this is just a great venue. And thank you so much for providing it.
It's been a whole lot of fun for me to do. And I am looking forward to, the rest of this year. And, next year we've got an election coming up. And that's going to be a big deal. Hey, let's talk about what the State House did last week. The House passed legislation. And this is a biggie that would require Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program recipients, SNAP recipients, to undergo identity verification and asset tests. I'll repeat, this is a big deal, Laura.
Yes, this has gotten some national attention. This bill, the Washington Post had a big story over the weekend and said this would be one of the strictest state asset tests for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which many people still call food stamps. It's the federal food assistance. It's 100% federally funded, although the state shares the administrative costs of the program with the federal government. So this is one of the most contentious bills, and this is something that the Iowa Senate has tried to do for about 4 or 5 years. But until this year, there was never a significant support for it in the Iowa House. This bill would, something resembling this bill would pass the Iowa Senate on party lines. It would get referred to the House Health and Human Services Committee, where it would die without a hearing. And a lot changed this year when early in the year, it was clear that the House, the leading House Republicans, including Speaker Pat Grassley, were co-sponsoring this bill. Now, the asset test is pretty strict. Households could have no more than $15,000 in assets. That does not include the value of the home. It doesn't include the value of the first car, and it doesn't include the value of a second vehicle if that is less than $10,000. But it includes almost everything else. And during the debate, this was something that a lot of people brought up on the Democratic side. And I think one reason why several Republicans did vote against this bill, that college savings accounts, all kinds of, even if as a baby, if you were given as a gift, savings bonds, all of those would count toward the asset test. And there might be a lot of people who have low incomes, but if you add up all their assets, it might be too much for this $15,000 level. And a lot of Democrats during the floor debate were telling personal stories about people they knew or constituents who had written to them worried that they were going to lose their food assistance if this bill went into effect. There also are going to be new limits, new verification for Medicaid recipients. They are not going to be subject to the asset test, but there are other factors that the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimated that this bill would result in about 8,000 Iowans losing their Medicaid. And some number of Iowans, the LSA estimated 2,800 Iowans would lose their federal food assistance. But in Pennsylvania, where they had a similar asset test, it turned out to be a much higher percentage of that. So the LSA was estimating that about 1% of SNAP recipients would lose their benefits. But in Pennsylvania, when they tried this, it was more like 13 or 14%.
The House had a lot of activity last week, and we'll keep you advised on all of it, including SNAP. But another thing the House did is the GOP leaders unveiled a new proposal to cut Iowans' property taxes as they try to strike a deal with the Senate before the end of this legislative session.
Property taxes are so complicated, Dennis, because the House and the Senate Republicans have different ideas about how to do this. Democrats were favorable toward the House bill that was unrolled last week, so I'm not sure whether that is going to help. I think the Senate Democrats were less thrilled about the idea of moving forward in the upper chamber. So the House plan, they say that it would reduce property taxes paid by Iowans by about $200 million. It's very complicated, the formula that they use. But the upshot would be that even if the value of your home increased significantly, your property tax bill would be capped so that it couldn't increase by more than 3% a year. That would apply to existing buildings, not new construction.
It is complex. We'll be following this one. The full House last week passed a bill that's going to let Iowans keep a gun in their car if the gun is out of sight and the car is locked on school and college grounds.
So, you know how I like to say, Dennis, always read the lobbyist declarations. And this was a classic example of that. So this was one of the bills that gun advocates have been wanting to pass for a while. And this year, with larger Republican majorities and with the fact with that constitutional amendment Iowans approved last November, they were going for this. This is something so that you could, as you mentioned, you could keep a loaded firearm in your car as long as it was out of sight and the car was locked. The original bill would not only cover schools and colleges, community colleges and state universities, but also it would have covered most workplaces so that people who have a license to, who are allowed to own a gun, could drive to work, keep the firearm locked in their car out of sight while at work. And the business lobbyists were very much against this. The lobbyist declarations indicated that they weren't against the bill as a whole. They were against those provisions. And so what happened shortly before passage is the floor manager, Stephen Holt, he amended the bill and it took out those provisions that affected most workplaces, workplace parking lots, but left in the provisions for schools and colleges. So this was a very emotional debate in the Iowa House. Lots of Democrats talking about gun violence and school shootings. And in fact, after the bill passed, a group of Democrats read out loud all the names of all of the schools where there have been mass shootings since the Columbine incident in 1999.
Oh, boy. All right. Another issue that Republicans across the country in many states are up in arms about, social media accounts. The House Ways and Means Committee in Iowa last week passed a bill requiring minors to get parental consent to create accounts on TikTok, Instagram, other social media platforms. It's just something that Republicans in particular across the United States seem to be up in arms about.
Yes, and the original bill, as you said, it would have banned minors from having accounts on social media. And this raised a lot of concerns about, because so many schools use social media networks or something resembling a social media network to get the word out, to accept assignments, to make announcements about school activities. And so the way the bill is written now, it says that these social media companies cannot collect certain types of information without consent of a parent. Enforcement is a big question mark. I guess the state of Utah passed something like this bill, and there are questions about whether it will be enforceable. But the Republicans seem to be determined to do something about this. I haven't heard Governor Reynolds say whether she would sign it, but I assume that since the bill is moving forward, that it's not something that she opposes.
And the House also passed a bill last week restricting drone surveillance of livestock facilities without the permission of the property owner. And this sounds perhaps very simple, but it's a part of a long fight involving property owners, livestock owners, and groups that want to go in and, shall we say, pull the rug back or the curtain back on what's going on there.
So this is really, I would call this a story that goes back more than a decade, but to 2012, when Iowa became the first state to pass what is known as an ag gag bill, a bill that limits recording or limits access to livestock facilities. And that first bill, the first law that was passed in 2012, was partly struck down in federal court. But the Iowa legislature has come back four different times to try to protect livestock facilities, give them special protection from trespassing, from unauthorized recording. And this is another example of that the agricultural interests, this is something that they've been interested in. I don't know how common this drone surveillance of livestock facilities is, but it has been portrayed as a threat to the livestock industry in Iowa.
And last week, the House approved a bill legalizing the sale of raw milk. Now, that may not be for everybody, but the House is saying it could be legal.
Actually, the Senate, just before we went on the air, the Iowa Senate passed this bill on a mostly party line vote. This was a bit of a scramble to get approval because a lot of, in conservative circles, a lot of people do support this. They view it as a freedom issue, being able to drink unpasteurized milk. But agricultural interests are very against this. Some would say for health reasons, some would say for competitive reasons. And Democrats raised during the debate, Megan Srinivas, who is an infectious disease doctor, talked about the problems that they've seen in some states where it's not just the person who drinks the milk who might be a threat, but that if that person works in food service, for instance, that person could then infect other people in the community and it can cause an outbreak. There was an amendment in the House that said that it added certain protections, like about the temperature that the milk would have to be stored. And it said things that, like, if the animal had been treated with antibiotics recently, that the livestock producer couldn't sell raw milk from that animal for a certain period of time. So that bought off enough votes to pass this bill. It passed on mostly party lines. Five Republicans voted against it, mostly people with ties to agriculture. Five Democrats voted for it. And just before we went on the air, the Iowa Senate did pass this bill. They agreed with the House amendment. All the Republicans voted for it, plus three Democrats. So it's headed to the governor's desk.
We needed our breaking news sounder.
Yes.
One more note before we cut away. The House passed on an overwhelming vote a bill prohibiting local governments in Iowa from banning specific dog breeds such as pit bulls or Rottweilers. Before you say, why would they need that? Well, 72 Iowa localities already ban pit bulls because a lot of folks think they're dangerous.
Yes, and this is something that's been controversial in a lot of parts of the country. And I think that the trend is moving away from these local ordinances, that really it should be that people say that the ordinances should be focused on whether the specific animal is dangerous and not on a breed, because it's not a very exact thing to say that a certain breed of dog is aggressive. And so the trend is away from that. This is also part of, I would say, a long-term trend, though, that the Republican-controlled legislature in Iowa has just about every year they have passed bills prohibiting local governments from regulating some kind of a thing. So in 2017, there was a bill undoing the five local governments that had passed minimum wage increases. And there have been other rules as well. And there are other bills pending this year, for instance, that would limit local government stormwater ordinances and topsoil ordinances related to flooding. So this is a general trend. I mean, this one had particular appeal to animal lovers, but I would say that there is more a general trend away from a local control in the Iowa legislature.
One more break now before we leave. It is now 15 minutes before the top of the hour, and you are in tune with an extended edition of KHOI's Capital Week. And I'm happy to welcome back my old friend, my good friend, my longtime friend. I think I've said it all the right way here. Tom Beal, one more time. He has a message about how you can help support this radio station. Thomas, it's yours.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Laura, for the wonderful program. I'm learning so much about what's going on. I'm just stunned, actually, at all the things that are happening right here in Iowa that I didn't really know about. Not that they haven't been reported someplace, but not with the analysis and not with the background information that you folks provide. So as I said earlier, this is a wonderful program that we are so proud to include in our broadcast schedule, and I hope the listeners feel the same way. I'm sure they do, or they wouldn't be listening, right? So if you feel that this program warrants your support, and all the other programs that we carry on KHOI, why don't you get on the web as soon as the program's over, go to khoifm.org/membership, and make a contribution. Or join and become a member of the KHOI family if you're not already there. Or if you are, how about moving up your membership to a higher level? Every penny you contribute goes to support the station and make sure that we can continue. We've been on the air for 10 years. Amazing when you think about this is a community enterprise and that we've been able to do it for 10 years. Because of you, our listeners, and because also of our wonderful contributors like Laura and Dennis, and for that matter, a lot of volunteers that you have heard and some you haven't heard who help keep the station on the air. So once again, khoifm.org/membership. Go to that site and make a contribution. And remember that every penny you give ensures the continuation of the station, and I think it's serving an incredible need right now, as a lot of the media have shrunk or collapsed as advertising revenue that supported them now goes elsewhere. Well, we don't have advertising. We have you. And so once again, khoifm.org/membership. Do your part to keep this great program on the air and this, I think, great station on the air. Thanks very much for your support already.
Tom, come on back next week. Laura and I will do another hour if you'll do cut-ins.
Well, it would be an honor, Dennis. I really do. I'm not kidding. I'm not just blowing smoke here. I think this is one of the great shows that we air. And frankly, I like virtually everything we air. But you guys do a terrific job.
Well, it is fun and a pleasure to work with you, Tom, and fun and a pleasure, obviously, to work with Laura. We have a good time. We really do. Laura and I, each week we communicate several times a week, sometimes in the middle of the night, by the way, and we put this show together. And Laura, you're laughing now, but it's fun, and I'm glad I didn't have to make a phone call to wake you up for this show.
Yes, I'm a night owl, and so I appreciate receiving Dennis's email with a proposed run of show and topics that we can discuss. And then it's the challenge is always figuring out what we can fit in our time.
That's the challenge. That's my job, to try to be the timekeeper here and keep us moving. So let's keep moving here. We have a few minutes left. Laura, the legislature hopes to adjourn by Friday, April 28th. That's a week from this coming Friday. Are they going to make it?
I'm pretty skeptical that they will make it. You never know. The negotiations are going on behind closed doors. And once they do agree on a budget, that probably those budget bills will be passed pretty quickly. But I think as I talk to people who work in and around the legislature, most people are expecting that it will go a little bit into May. A lot of years, the legislative session does spill into early to mid-May. And I'll be pretty surprised if they get out of town by April 28th.
We'll be here to document it, whatever happens. One more legislative note before we go to other things. It's about State Representative Josh Turek.
Yes, he is the new House Democrat representing one of the districts in Council Bluffs. He barely won that seat by 6 votes, but just recently he was inducted into the Wheelchair Basketball Hall of Fame. He is a former professional basketball player and a 4-time Paralympian and 2-time gold medalist. And the Iowa House Minority Leader, Jennifer Converse, had to get up and announce this because Josh Turek apparently doesn't like talking about himself and his accomplishments. But he uses a wheelchair, and he is very active during Iowa House debate, talking about how various bills that are proposed would affect people with disabilities. And this was just something that was recognized during a point of personal privilege.
And you and I were on the air on election night in November on KHOI when he won his seat by 6 votes.
Yes, and there was a recount, but the recount upheld the results.
All right, we have sad news to report now. An important LGBTQ rights advocate has passed away, and she was very important indeed.
Yes, Sharon Malero, this was unexpected when this happened last week. She was an attorney with the Davis Brown Law Firm in Des Moines, and one of the leaders, legendary is a word that's overused, but it is apt in this case. Sharon Malero was an absolutely legendary figure within the LGBTQ advocacy community. She was a co-founder of the group One Iowa, and she was very involved in just about every important legal case. Actually, the first year I was covering Iowa politics at Bleeding Heartland in 2007, she was very involved in the effort to add sexual orientation and gender identity to Iowa Civil Rights Act. That was something that happened the first year of the Democratic trifecta in 2007. And then she was a lead attorney on that case, the Varnum case, which in 2009 led to the unanimous Iowa Supreme Court decision that made Iowa just the third state at that time to legalize same-sex marriage, striking down the Iowa's Defense of Marriage Act. And she was involved in other cases after that. During the 2010s, there was an important case that said that same-sex spouses, that both names could be on a child's birth certificate or a child's death certificate. Those were separate cases, but she was involved in both of them, and her passing was unexpected. And I just want to extend my condolences to all of her friends and loved ones. She will be missed.
She passed away at the age of 67, way, way too young. All right. Last week, a federal judge in North Dakota temporarily blocked a federal rule in 24 states, including Iowa, that was intended to protect thousands of small streams, wetlands, and other waterways. What's this all about?
This is about the Waters of the U.S. rule. And this is something that the Iowans in Congress, the Republicans, have criticized harshly. The Obama administration passed this rule. There's a lot of disagreement between the advocates for the agriculture community and advocates for the environmental community don't agree on the interpretation of this rule. But it's called the WOTUS rule, Waters of the U.S. It's a U.S. EPA rule. The Trump administration repealed the Obama administration's rule, and the Biden administration put something into effect that didn't go as far as the original Obama administration rule, but it goes a lot farther than what Republicans like. So this lawsuit is challenging the EPA's ability to regulate waterways and which kinds of waterways. And so in the farming advocacy community, some people say that this would allow the federal government to regulate ditches and puddles and small ponds on farms, and that's what's in dispute. And so for right now, this enforcement of this rule is blocked while this litigation continues.
Laura, we have about 3 minutes left. Let's go down to Brenna Byrd, the state attorney general, joining 21 other states in a letter opposing the Biden administration's Department of Energy regulations that would affect gas stoves.
Yes, this is an example of the attorney general. She said when she was running for office last year that she was going to give Joe Biden the bird, and she was going to be very active. She has asked the legislature for additional funding to hire attorneys to work primarily on federal litigation to challenge Biden administration initiatives. And on the website of the Iowa Attorney General's office, they proudly announced many of the actions, the multi-state legal actions that she has joined, challenging many policies, some of them in the agriculture area. This one, again, would be for a Department of Energy regulations that are proposed. They haven't been finalized. That would affect gas stoves. I should say that Iowa is not a state where gas stoves are particularly common, but this is something that Brenna Byrd has talked about doing and advertises. The one area where the Attorney General has not gone out of her way to get a lot of publicity is her intervention in some of the abortion cases. She never put up a press release on the website that talked about joining the Republican attorney's effort to support that Texas lawsuit we talked about early in the program, that where the goal is to revoke the FDA approval of mifepristone. Iowa is on record supporting that effort, but that's something that Brenna Byrd has not talked about publicly.
And very briefly, about a minute, Iowa is no longer reporting weekly coronavirus cases to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It appears to be the only state in the union not doing that.
Yes, and the Iowa COVID-19 tracker, Sarah Ann Willett, was very frustrated to see this. She tries to track the disease reporting across the country, and her maps now have a big gray space where Iowa is. And it is true, the state officials said that they think that because the results are not as meaningful as they once were, because so many people are taking these at-home tests and not reporting it to anyone, that the case numbers are not as valuable. I should say that I still think that the hospitalization numbers and the weekly death numbers, those did give some people some idea of how the virus was spreading and what was going on. And so it is, as you mentioned, Iowa is the only state that stopped that reporting, and that's something that frustrated some researchers who work in this area.
We had extra time tonight, and brother, did we need it. What are you looking for this week, Laura?
Well, the Senate is going to be continuing to move forward on a lot of Governor Reynolds' nominees. The Democrats no longer have the votes to block any of the nominees, but some of those are passing on close to full party line votes. So we'll be running that down next week. I'm going to be watching later tonight. The Senate is going to be debating a trucking tort reform bill, shielding commercial trucking companies from liability. And the child labor bill appears to be moving forward in the Senate, but the version I think is slightly different from what has passed the House, or what has passed the committee in the House. So those are among the bills I'll be watching this week.
And we will talk about all of them next week. I'll wait for your overnight emails this morning. How's that? Early this morning. That's it. We're out of time for this extended edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I are going to catch our breath now. After all, we've been talking a long time tonight. We're going to be back next Monday night with Mr. Thomas Beal at 7 o'clock for Capital Week, where we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style. As always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time, and we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.
Support your local radio station. Go to khoifm.org/membership.